Hi, I'm Tyler Batson.
And I'm Maria Pritchard.
I'm a documentary filmmaker and activist who's traveled the world to prove that peace is possible, even in the most unlikely spaces.
And I'm a social entrepreneur who wants to know what resilience looks like when we stop resisting.
And this is
Act of Isms,
a podcast creating opportunities for connection and compassion through conversation and action.
Act of Isms is all about introducing you to new ways to engage. And we understand that every purchase you make is a vote for what you believe in.
So naturally, we gravitate towards mission-driven companies, which is why we've partnered with Waiakea. Waiakea is a brand built on three values that activisms can confidently stand behind.
Healthy, sustainable, and ethical.
That's right. This volcanic water is naturally filtered through thousands of feet of lava rock, enhancing it with a unique blend of minerals, giving your body an alkaline pH.
Waiakea uses 100% post-recycled RPET bottles, low-emission shipping, and actively participates in regional reforestation, making them one of the first certified carbon-neutral beverages on the planet.
And best of all, for every liter of Waiakea you buy, Waiakea donates 1 week of clean drinking water to those in need.
So if you're going to buy bottled water, buy with Mother Earth in mind.
Go to store.waiakeasprings.com and use offer code ACTOFISMS to get a 10% discount on your first purchase or delivery subscription. When you support Waiakea, remember, you're also supporting this podcast. So thank you very much.
All right, now let's get into this episode.
Let's do it.
Today, we are talking about sexism. And we put a lot of thought into this episode, not just because it's a hot topic, but because it's a heavy, complex, loaded, confusing topic.
And we had a lot of conversations about who we could bring on and what we could talk about. And there's so many facets and corners of this issue. And ultimately, we decided that we weren't comfortable asking someone to come here and tell us their story of assault again.
Yeah.
The Me Too movement was extremely powerful and also opened a lot of wounds for people that maybe they were or weren't ready to face. And I think that's been part of the impact culturally, that now all this information is out there and people are kind of walking around with this vulnerability and not sure what to do with it.
It's like this ticking bomb that's been going off inside of people for a long time. And you kind of want to control the explosion a little bit, you know, especially if it's your pain, your wounds, your story. I mean, I know I personally, I didn't want to tell my story, you know, go on Instagram, hashtag it Me Too, and join the conversation because I was not ready.
And that's something I've really struggled with as a woman who has had many experiences with this stuff. Can I be a strong woman, a good feminist, a empowered person, and not be ready to share? Also, is it my responsibility to share? Do I have to share what happened to me in order for change to occur?
Maybe the question isn't do you have to, but do you want to?
I think that in the past, I haven't been ready. And that has created some shame for me. And I've never shared this story because I felt that if I told people everything that happened by the end of the story, they would blame me too, because I blame myself. But today, I do feel ready to talk about at least one experience that I've had.
Please go ahead.
My heart's kind of racing. I was in New York and I had an experience with a cab driver where I ended up in a really terrifying situation. What happened was I was in New York. I was having brunch with a friend before leaving on my flight to LA and we were drinking. And I remember what I was wearing. I was wearing these short overalls and a little crop top, and my hair was in pigtail buns, and we'd been at a music festival all weekend. And I tried to extend my trip, and when I called the airline, they were like, it's going to be $500 to stay and change your flight. And so I was like, okay, fine, I'll go to the airport. But I was trying to stay until the very last minute. So I called a cab, was running late, go outside, get in my cab, and the cab driver is like, oh, you need to go to the airport? Well, I can't take you all the way to the airport, but I'll take you to my friend and then he'll take you the rest of the way.
What was going through your head in that moment?
I was like, this is weird, but I just need to get to the airport. So whatever, just get me to the airport. So we ride in the cab. We get switched over to the other cab driver, and he was probably in his 20s. He was very young. I also had to stop at my friend's place to get my suitcase. So I go to get my suitcase and the cab driver like follows me into the apartment. I'm like, this is kind of invasive, but whatever. Grab my suitcase, come out, everything's okay. Put my suitcase in the car. And he was like, you don't have to sit in the back seat. And I was like, oh yeah, like I'm not afraid of anything. I'm going to sit in the front seat. Like this is just a regular guy.
I'm a strong, independent woman. I'll sit in the front seat.
Exactly. So I get in the cab. I'm in the front seat. We're driving. I'm kind of drunk. And this guy, I think, noticed that I was drunk and asked me if I wanted to smoke some weed. And I was like, sure, I'm up for anything. So he like hands me a joint. I smoke some weed. We're still driving. We're getting closer to the airport. And then all of a sudden, we're in a neighborhood and I can see the airport is close. Like I see the planes taking off and landing, flying around the sky. And then I notice like we've passed that house before. And I realized that we're driving in circles and I'm checking the time and, you know, reminding this guy when my flight is. And then I call him out and I say, are we driving in circles? I think the airport's right there. Why are you turning right? He just pulls over and unzips his pants and pulls out his penis and basically insinuates, we're not going to the airport. And like, he wants me to suck his dick, to put it bluntly, or else he's not going to take me to the airport.
Did you say anything?
I freak out. I'm drunk. I'm high. I'm alone. I'm in a neighborhood that I've never seen before. I'm afraid of missing my flight. And I just start shaking and crying. And I call my friend and she's like, just get out of the car. Get out of the car. I'm sending my boyfriend to come get you. Just like go to the nearest house.
So what was the cab driver doing?
The cab driver starts to panic because I'm on the phone with someone telling them what's happening to me. So I'm like getting out of the cab and the guy's trying to like get me back in the cab and is like, just get back in the car. Just don't tell anyone. Don't call the cops. Like I'll take you to the airport. Just, you know, like don't prosecute me. And I remember thinking like, this guy's truly scared. And so I decided to get back in the car with this guy, which in, you know, after the fact, I was like, I can't believe I decided to do that. But he drove me to the airport. I sat in the back seat. And then when we got to the airport, the craziest thing I did was I pulled out my credit card and I paid for the cab.
What?
I know. Why did I think this guy deserved my money after assaulting me?
And he accepted it?
Yeah.
No question.
And gave me a receipt. So I get out of the cab. I run through the airport. I'm so late. I'm sobbing. I'm carrying all my things. I just run to the front of the line. And I'm like, I'm about to miss my flight. They let me cut to the front, get me on the plane. And I just literally cry the entire plane ride home to LA.
Did anybody ask you along that way once you got to the airport, whether it was the people checking you in or stewardesses?
No.
No one asked you what was going on?
No.
Did you want them to?
I think so, because I felt so terrified and so violated, and I was already in the shame and blame and beating myself up and feeling like all of this was my fault and how could I have gotten myself in this situation? And the fact that I was running through an airport sobbing and hysterical and nobody said anything to me, much less the person who sat next to me on the airport, made me feel even more invisible and even more like, this is my fault.
Yeah, and validated in your shame.
Exactly. So I got back to LA. I went and stayed with a friend that night because I couldn't be alone. And even just getting in my car and driving from the airport alone, walking to my car alone through the airport parking lot, all of these things were terrifying. I felt so vulnerable and exposed. Like at any moment, someone was just going to attack me.
You were still in shock.
Absolutely. And I ultimately shared that something happened with my mother. I didn't tell her all these details because I felt, again, like it was absolutely my fault. But because I had paid for the cab on my credit card, my mom took that information and did all of this research and basically found the cab company, found like the form with New York where I could press charges. And, you know, she did everything to just put in my hands, go prosecute this person. And I remember as she was going through all this research and this process, I didn't want to be part of it. And I know that she did it for me because she knew I couldn't. And then when she gave me the power to do it, I kept putting it off. And then I just decided I can't.
Why?
That was absolutely rooted in blaming myself and knowing that in this current system that we have, all of those things that I did, you know, got in the cab drunk, wore the outfit I was wearing, switched cabs, let him follow me into the apartment, accepted weed, accepted a beer, drank in a car. You know, all of these things would be called into question and I would have been blamed and shamed beyond what I was already doing to myself. And I just wasn't capable of going through that at that point in my life.
That moment that you told your mom, was that a cry for help? What was that motivated by?
I think I wanted to be seen. I wanted someone I loved, someone who loved me, to say it was okay. If any woman came up to me and told me that happened to her, I would say, this is not your fault. You were assaulted. You had an expectation of safety and that was violated.
And yet it sounds like when it happened to you, it was hard for you to believe that. You really blamed yourself.
And that's why this experience was so powerful for me, because it helped me to understand other women who don't come forward. It helped me to understand women who endure these experiences over and over, because as strong as you are, when it happens to you, it's just different. And it's so much easier to be strong for someone else than to be that for yourself, at least for me. And I also know that the person I was then, I didn't have a strong sense of self-worth. I didn't have a strong sense of self-love. And
if this happened to you today, do you think it would be any different?
I honestly don't know. All I know is that the person I was in that moment to tell my mom was the best I could do. And in the last 5 or 6 years since it happened, like, I've slowly revealed more and more of this story to people who are dear in my life.
So what has the healing process been like for you?
I actually feel that the healing process has just emerged. Like, I buried it. And then these like small little weeds keep growing up that are like, acknowledge me, you know? And every time since, honestly, that I've gotten in a cab or an Uber and I'm by myself, I never sit in the front seat anymore. I'm not as friendly because I feel like that's a threat to my safety. I don't care if I come off as unfriendly. It's more important to me that I feel like safe and empowered. And maybe eventually that will change. But where I am today, it's more important for me to honor the things that keep me feeling safe, even if it's a little bit guarded, than to do things that I'm not comfortable with just to appear healed. Because I think that a lot of the choices I made that day were rooted in appearing liberated and free and fearless. And underneath there was a voice that was like, I don't really want to do this, but I'm doing it anyway. So today, like listening to that voice, that intuitive voice is the most important thing to me.
How has your personal definition of being liberated and free changed since then?
In so many ways. I don't drink anymore or use any substances, which are things that used to make me feel free. But I realized that they were really just another guard. And so taking those things out of my life has been extremely liberating in allowing me to find that person that I really am, knowing that it's always in motion and it's always changing. And that's why I say, you know, like the way I handled the situation back then, I don't know if that's how I would handle it today. I don't know if that's how I would handle it in 10 years. And hopefully I don't have to live that experience again. But I just did the best I could then, and I'm doing the best I can now.
Well, I think you're doing a damn good job.
Thank you.
If anything good has come from this experience, what is it?
I no longer believe that I deserved this. I no longer blame myself. I no longer hold the shame that it was my fault.
Can we just pause at that moment? Say that again.
I no longer blame myself for this. I no longer hold the shame, and I no longer think this is my fault. This happened to me. I have carried it with me since. I carry it with me today, and it will always be part of me in the future. And my responsibility and my choice is how I carry this experience.
I think some of the themes that you're touching on are really the difference between justice and peace. So what for you is the difference between justice and peace?
Yeah, well, I think I've definitely arrived at peace with this. You know, I'm at peace with my decision not to prosecute. I'm at peace with the choices I made that day. I'm at peace because I'm able to talk about it today, and I'm able to honestly tell you every single moment of that story without feeling shame. Whereas justice would have been taking this person to court and them being prosecuted. And then I would still have to start the process of emotional healing. And I'm not saying don't prosecute, because if you are emotionally capable of that, I do think that leads to radical social change that we need. But I'm also saying, you know, I hesitate to use the word victim, but as victims, I don't believe we should be forced to do anything. This is my experience, and I get to choose how to move forward with it. And if that means I'm not emotionally ready to take legal action, then that's my choice. I don't have to harm myself twice by prosecuting when I'm not ready.
One of the things that I can imagine is that there are a lot of women out there not coming forward with their stories, that are not posting on social media about their stories, who have no interest in participating in this movement, but can sit there alone and say, yeah, me too. What do you have to say to them?
I think that's absolutely, you're right. And I wouldn't recommend not processing it, but you absolutely do not have to process it publicly. I believe in our energetic connection, and I believe in all of us, you know, contributing to each other's healing. And I think that even healing privately contributes to the vibration of us all healing.
Whatever you're processing, however you're processing it, contributes to a greater culture of healing.
There is no black and white. There is no rule book for this. We're in the middle of it. You know, things are changing and everything is stirred up right now. And there will be clarity eventually. There will be a culture shift. I believe in that. But there is no right way. There is no wrong way. We're all learning through our experiences individually and collectively. What I learned through my experience is that that internal voice knows a lot. If you feel like someone else's opinion about how to process is threatening to that internal voice, you're probably right. Listen to that voice because that is your strongest barometer of what is right for you.
Tell us more about this culture shift. What does it look like to you?
I think the culture shift is creating more space to talk about how complicated this is. Consent and assault are so much deeper than what we see on the surface. Sometimes a man might think from the interaction that everything is okay. And a woman might be having a deep internal conflict about the situation. They might be saying nothing, but inside they're saying no. They might be saying yes, but inside they're saying, get me out of here. They might be saying maybe, but inside they're saying, if I say yes, maybe he'll be my boyfriend. And I give these examples because I've lived them. I think it just showcases how complex these issues are, that we can't say, unless it's a hell yes, it's not consent, because people say yes to save their lives. People say yes for all kinds of reasons that are still assault, no matter what gender we are or our sexual orientation. The work begins with each of us healing our relationship with ourselves, getting more connected to that internal voice. Because just as a woman knows deep inside of her whether she wants to or doesn't, a man also deep within himself knows whether a woman is enthusiastic or not. I really believe that the culture shift begins with us talking about all of this and the complexity of it, and that, you know, sex ed isn't about how to put on a condom, but about exploring the emotional complexity of intimacy.
There's a lot that we have to do with educating men and boys too. I remember growing up and as a teenager, I was still a virgin. I was still figuring out my own sexuality, how I wanted to express that. And I remember one of my peers, this boy, saying kind of out of nowhere, no means yes, yes means harder. And everybody laughed. I did not laugh. I was like, wait, no, that doesn't make sense, you know? And then I really had to think to myself, where is he hearing this? But it made everybody laugh. It made everybody feel as though they had to laugh.
The masculine energy has that dominating power, that when messaging comes from this masculine space, it quiets. It's like there's no space for argument. This must be the fact. And that's why that statement had that power of, okay, now we all giggle. We accept that this must be the way it is.
Or at the very least, that we can take what a woman desires for her safety lightly.
Right. And the feminine quality is more available, creating space for the other person to communicate. And I'm not saying that's easy. I don't like doing that. It's terrifying. It's so vulnerable. It's a lot easier to not talk about it or take that domineering perspective of this is the way it's going to be, because it's not as threatening. You feel like the other person can't say no. Mm-hmm. And if someone says no, then I feel rejected. I think that's a lot of what we see, is that we put out this dominating energy and it really comes from a place of fear of rejection. And that if we put it out in a way where no is off the table, then rejection's not an option and my ego's intact. When men are able to come forward and talk about their experiences and the way that they have done things that were harmful and how they see that now, I think that is an opportunity.
I'm thinking about the cabbie, and it seems pretty clear by your telling of the story that he, at least in that moment, felt guilt.
Absolutely.
Shame even.
Mm-hmm.
Concern for his safety.
Yes.
Assuming he's listening, what would you say to him?
You know, I don't know this person at all, but the story that made sense to me is that it felt to me like this person was also doing something he didn't want to do. It felt like there was pressure for him to do this. In that moment when I really saw his fear, it felt like this is not authentic to this person. They're going against their intuitive self as much as I was. I have always felt like if I saw this person again, I would say to them, you don't have to do this. And whoever or whatever is telling you that this is what you have to do to be a man, it's not true. You are enough without having to force a woman to be with you. And I think that is potentially underneath a lot of these experiences.
I think you're probably right.
It's interesting because we were having such a parallel experience, you know? Like each step I was feeling uncomfortable with what I was doing, and each step he was trying to get a little bit more confident with going through with this.
He was uncomfortable as well.
Yeah. And ultimately, when it came to circling around that neighborhood, he didn't pull over until I asked him why he was circling. And from every moment forward, it just really felt like he was just as scared as I was. You know, someone who was really practiced at this or was really violent would have just driven away with my suitcase and left me.
Or been physically abusive to you in the car. There were so many opportunities for this situation to escalate.
Absolutely. And when I was having that phone call, he was just pleading with me, get back in the car, get back in the car. I'll take you to the airport. Don't tell anyone.
You had the time to get out your phone, to dial the number.
Yeah.
Get somebody on the phone, have a conversation.
Yeah.
He didn't want to be doing what he was doing.
I don't think so. It was clear to me that he was having his own internal conflict.
I don't think it's just that he didn't want to get caught.
No, it was that he was uncomfortable. It was as if someone had told him how to do this, but he didn't want to. And I felt that way when I left. And I guess, you know, maybe that is what allows me to have some compassion for this person. I felt like telling him, you don't have to do this. And I almost feel like if I had said that, he would have just stopped. Because I think that's really what he wanted to hear. And I think there were influences that were bigger that were telling him this is what he had to do to be a man.
Toxic masculinity.
Absolutely.
I feel like he felt himself becoming the poison.
Yeah.
That he was inviting that in and he couldn't see himself anymore.
I mean, I don't remember this person's face, but I do remember their body language. And I remember the terror and anxiety he appeared to be experiencing. It felt very clear to me through his body language.
That's not something you can fake.
Nor would you want to when you're trying to exert power over another person.
My head keeps going back to his point of view, watching you grab your bags, taking your receipt, running, sobbing into the airport. This is not my story, obviously, but I feel very present in the way that you tell it. And coupling that with other experiences that I've had, I really, and this may get me in trouble, but I do have compassion for the guy.
I think that the fear of having compassion for these people who have done horrible acts is threatening to us moving through this period of sexism and misogyny and rape culture. If we want toxic masculinity to change, we also have to have compassion for the people who are growing up with this embedded in them, passed down from their father or their uncle or their idol or whoever, to not hold space for that compassion is threatening to our ability to move forward.
Otherwise, we end up with a lot of enraged people, which is completely justifiable. But if we end up with a lot of enraged people who are just pointing the finger at all the monsters in the room, we're going to end up with a lot of monsters in the room.
Right.
It's giving people the freedom to change if that's what we truly want.
It's controversial to say, I have compassion for the person who tried to rape me. But I do. And I'm going to say that I'm okay with whatever negative feedback I get back on that, because I believe that is the path forward. That to understand that what this person did to me is absolutely 100% wrong. And he too was a victim of the environment, which showed him that this was the way to be a man. He's suffering in his own way too. Doesn't excuse what he did, but to acknowledge that he's a victim of circumstances as well creates a path forward for people like him.
For healing.
Yes.
I have to say, though, for you to tap into your intuitive knowing as well as his, your attacker's, that is a skill that should not be downplayed. That speaks to your character. It speaks to the power of intuition. Intuition that I think we all carry with us.
Yeah. I think we all have that intuitive voice, and the journey is to create a relationship with it and to learn how to use it.
You probably taught that guy something by acknowledging your intuitive voice.
I like to think that after that experience, he knew that behavior was not for him and that he never did that again. I don't know that, but that's what I felt.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you for holding space. Thank you to all the listeners for holding space. And, you know, part of this podcast is about creating safe spaces. That is why we decided not to ask anyone to come forward, but instead to share the parts of our stories that we feel safe sharing. We've just tapped the tip of the iceberg of sexism. I would like to have an open invitation to our listeners. If you are ready to talk about something, we're here for you.
Absolutely.
And this space is for you. Send us an email, a direct message. No one should have to walk through this alone. And don't forget to check out Sexism Part 2, where Tyler bravely shares his Me Too story. And please follow, like, share, subscribe, and leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Talk to you soon.